not her own, but acts like something's different from the eyebrows up. Seems like only yesterday, R-D-I-V-O-R-C. I love you both, and Yuletide is pure H-E-double-L for me. And we just go nuts at Christmas time. That's when everything falls apart. We just go nuts at Christmas time. But it's another year before we're together again.
Hi, this is John of They Might Be Giants. If you're driving in your car right now, we urge you to sit back, relax, close your eyes, and drive really fast.
We just go nuts at Christmas time. That's when everything falls apart. We just go nuts at Christmas time. But it's another year before we're together
again.
To Radio Radio.
I wanna brand new car, a 20 guitar.
Well, ho, ho, and indeed, ho. Season's greetings, pop pickers, or to anybody listening from across the pond in the USA, of which I'm sure a few of you are, yo, dude, happy holidays. I think that's the kind of thing you say, isn't it? We don't really say that over here, but anyway. My name's Gareth Jones, and you're listening to Radio Radio, an occasional series of podcasts presented by me from my cold, damp flat in Bristol in the UK. And I say it's an occasional podcast. I'm really quite slack. The last one of these I made was way back in July when I covered the Indie Tracks Festival. So it's taken a long time before I've made another one. But you know when people say you wait for a bus and you wait ages and then suddenly two come along at once? Well, it's a little bit like that with my podcast. It's been ages since I've done one and now two are going to come along at once. Yes, two editions of my podcast for December, for Christmas. This one, which is a They Might Be Giants edition, and then we've got my annual Christmas special, which, let's be honest, it's the most wonderful time of the year, to quote Andy Williams, because I collect indie alternative Christmas records, so once a year I get to bring them out of the cupboard and share them with you, the listener. So my Christmas special, that's coming out next week. I mean, obviously I don't know when you're listening to this, but this week, They Might Be Giants, next week, Christmas special. But you could be listening to this and downloading this at any point. So, but basically, two editions of my podcast will be available in a short space of each other. This is a They Might Be Giants edition, and we had two Christmas songs to start the show, including They Might Be Giants, both originally by 60s garage psych band The Sonics. First up was a cover of Don't Believe in Christmas by, Junior Varsity. Now, I've tried to find some information up about them. Don't know anything, really. They're from Whitney Houston. They're from Houston, USA. And I guess from what I can make out, they do a kind of 50s thing, and they're quite young. So I suppose they're kind of like an American version of Kitty, Daisy and Lewis. So Junior Varsity covering Don't Believe in Christmas. And then we had They Might Be Giants with their version of the Sonics' Santa Claus, which was available on their Holidayland EP released a few years ago. So, it's Radio Radio with me, Gareth Jones. Obviously, I've already told you that, but I know American shows always recap information. And in a moment, I'll be speaking to John Flansburgh, one half of They Might Be Giants. I had the pleasure of meeting John in his hotel prior to a show at Shepherd's Bush Empire in London. And they don't play the UK very often. They played a few dates in the UK, and then they went over to Germany and Berlin. It was a great moment. I actually had half an hour with him, roundabout, which I wasn't expecting. I thought I'd probably get about 10 minutes or something. So it was a great pleasure to meet John, and we'll be talking about all sorts of things, but not what the record label were anticipating, because I didn't discuss the new album. And obviously it's all about plugging and talking about new material. So they have a new album out. It was released this year called Nanobots. 25 tracks in 45 minutes. Now, you know, that's going some. Obviously, some of the songs are pretty damn short. But I never talked about the new album when I spoke to John. So apologies for that. We don't discuss the album at all. But it is out now. It is available. It's called Nanobots. 25 songs, 45 minutes. So I was just doing the plugs there to keep everybody happy. So before we speak to John, this is the lead track from the album Nanobots. This is Nanobots.
Grow the nanobots. Grow the nanobots. Grow them in the cracks.
Grow them in the cracks. In the sidewalk.
Line
the nanobots up.
Line them up and ask.
Line them up and ask them a question. Raise the yellow bots up.
Raise them up and make.
Raise them up and make them respect us. Line the marching bots up.
Line them up and wish.
Line them up and wish them away. What with all. Cells awaken now, this is your time. Hear the voices calling to their confederates. See the tiny figures testing their limbs. Stand back and watch them grow.
Grow them in the cracks, in the sidewalk.
Wind the nanobots up. Wind
them up,
wish them away. available in some hand-me-downs. Making do with leftovers, bunking up, sharing comic books, sitting 3 deep on each other's laps, in a van stacked up on other vans, driving on a tidal wave where they grow the nanobots.
Grow the nanobots.
Grow them in the cracks,
grow
in the sidewalk. Wind the
nanobots
and
the nanobots.
They might be giants with Nanobots from the album Nanobots. And it's been a fairly productive year for They Might Be Giants. They do keep themselves very busy. Not only the release of the new album, but they also put out a free iPhone app. Now, if anybody's seen me with my mobile phone, I've still got an ancient Nokia little mini phone. It's just about good enough for sending texts and making phone calls. And even then, it's a little bit ropey. But if you do have a modern phone, then get yourself onto iTunes, where they have a free phone app you can download. It's just called They Might Be Giants, and it's very similar to their old Dial-A-Song service. It plays a new They Might Be Giants song every day of the week. A marvellous piece of technology. I'm just trying to get all the plugs in, because none of this was mentioned in the interview. So, the new album, the iPhone app. They also put out a second DVD compilation this year of their music videos, although sadly lacking the video of Boss of Me from Malcolm in the Middle, presumably because Fox owned the rights to it, and it would probably cost loads of money to get the rights to it and things. And also, they've just literally in the last couple of weeks, right at the beginning of December, there's been a re-release of some of the They Might Be Giants back catalogue. The four albums they released on Elektra Records have been reissued in deluxe 2CD editions. And it comes with new liner notes, new packaging, and bonus tracks, including various B-sides and tracks that weren't released in the UK. The B-sides from Sexy, S-E-X-X-Y, the B-sides from the guitar, various tracks that weren't actually available over in the UK originally. They're on these new repackaged editions. That's The Flood and Apollo 18. There is a 2CD set together. And then John Henry and Factory Showroom, both of them released together on 2CDs. So those are out now. I think Rhino Records have put those out. So the back catalogue is out. And new album, iPhone app, DVD. And also on their website is lots of merchandise. But we'll be discussing the merchandise during the interview. So that's all the plugging done. I've done all the plugging. I did it all for him. No need to plug anything, John. I've done it for you. So let's get on with the interview. I'm sure you've been waiting. But first, we might as well hear the voice of John. We did at the start. We heard him sing Santa Claus. But this is, John Lanell, probably most known in this country for singing Birdhouse in Your Soul. John Flansburgh, on the other hand, is probably most known in this country for singing this, the theme to Malcolm in the Middle. This is Boss of Me, and we'll be speaking to John after this.
Yes, no, maybe.
John Flansburgh, one half of They Might Be Giants. You're always introduced as one half of They Might Be Giants. I kind of feel sad for the other members of the band, because you are a band.
Yes, we are. Well, we're also a duo. You know, John Lanell and I started the band about 30 years ago, and we spent the first 10 years working as a duo and had a lot of early success just as a duo. Then we've taken on with live sidemen, and we've had some of the same sidemen for the better part of 17 years now, and we've been working with our drummer, I guess, for about 11 years now, and we still call him the new guy. So it's kind of a funny situation, because we really we're tighter than a lot of bands that have been around a lot shorter period but are still considered bands. It's not a democracy, you know, what we're doing. I mean, it's, you know, we are the band leaders and we sort of have those responsibilities. But it works and it's a very creative enterprise and everybody's voice is heard. It's not just like, you know, we get some ringer guy. I mean, they are ringers. One thing we've discussed is like, if you were in a band in our position where we have to hire people to work with, be the side members in the band, like if you're going to hire a drummer or a bass player or a second guitar player, you're not going to hire somebody who's worse than you. When you hire somebody who's actually technically better than you, you're kind of it's a really unusual dynamic because you're kind of losing some of your power as a musical voice in what you're doing because they're technically better than you. I mean, it really undermines your authority as just like a creative person. So it's sort of a character test for us to, you know, figure out the ideas that we want to put forward and have them be bold enough that we can justify them without them being maybe as shiny as other things.
Do you still write and demo as a duo, or do you get the band involved with that?
Well, we never really wrote, and we never wrote together as much as we probably even liked. I think, you know, we're actually tremendously shy of one another when it comes to, like, getting down to that, like, creative process. We've done a lot of things, blind collaborations, or one-way, I don't know what you call it, like a one-way collaboration where, like, you hand off something to the other person. I've written a lot of lyrics and put together a fair number of tracks that I've given to John Linnell, and he's sort of created, you know, fleshed out songs. There are songs in our catalog. I mean, I guess Mink Car is probably a song from our catalog that's most notable, that like was actually constructed by sitting down in a room together and just writing a song the way a Tin Pan Alley set of songwriters would put together something. But a lot of times it's a collaboration more like, and I only mean this technically, it's more like the collaboration between Lennon and McCartney, which is that like there's a clear leader of who put the song together, and like the other person is often kind of the auxiliary person who can come up with like a good twist or work as the first audience or be the editor or you know, just be there when you're needed. And if you're not needed,
which one's Lennon, which one's McCartney?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, John Lennon and Paul McCartney wrote many songs apart from one another that are credited together. Mm-hmm. And all I'm trying to say is the form of their collaboration is actually we kind of echo.
Sure.
Which is we try to stay out of each other's way a little bit. I would say I'm Ringo.
Look at her in the alley by the light switch. Who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
It's great when you're back in the UK. Obviously, we don't get to see you that much because you don't need to be here. You do so well in America.
Well, we do have steady work in America. I'd love to be here more often.
But although the fans love you dearly, the press still just regard you as a kind of one-hit wonder. You're actually a two-hit wonder.
Uh-huh.
Boss of Me from Malcolm in the Middle.
Sure.
Charted as well. So you're a two-hit wonder now, which is kind of nice.
I guess so. It's interesting to me that the... at some point I would imagine that the British press would evolve from the thank you for playing our game posture that they have. You know, one thing about Rolling Stone, you know, for all its shortcomings as a magazine and a sort of subcultural part of the United States, it allows people who are, you know, preoccupied with their love of popular music to sort of age out gracefully. You know, I guess Mojo and Q magazine sort of do that a little bit. But still, it seems very superstar-oriented. It doesn't really allow for people to kind of have more wide-open tastes. You know, I think the biggest mistake that people make when they think of a band like They Might Be Giants is they think that, like, we're some kind of cult or that there's some kind of secret handshake to being into what we're doing. And, you know, the truth is, like, in many ways, you know, what we're doing is quite conservative and is designed... It would hold appeal to people who, you know, enjoy verses and choruses and melodies and bridges and vocal harmony and all sorts of things that are quite old-fashioned in a way. And we have a lot of fans who are that, you know, I mean, who are sort of more musical traditionalists.
I often think I think a big hit is a danger because it can have almost a worse effect than having no hits.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, having a hit in the UK was, I mean, we worked very steadily for 5 years before we had a hit in the UK, touring Germany on an annual basis and, getting really deep into, we would be playing like a, almost tertiary cities in Germany and having a grand old time. And it all seemed remarkably close to a professional career. Then as soon as we had a radio hit in the UK and in Europe, it was like, well, that's over now. And we really barely have been able to come back. But at the same time, we were also crisscrossing the United States, which is a very large market and tends to be extremely loyal and have like a very long institutional memory. I mean, if you actually can do a good show, every band needs a gimmick. And, for us, it's like we actually put on a good show. It makes it quite different than your average rock experience. A lot of bands have, breakout songs and they figure out how to put on an okay show, but they don't really address like how to do something that's a whole solid piece of musical entertainment. So we just got better. I mean, we had a lot of earn as you learn kind of experiences, we got a lot of on the job training, and we've just done a lot of shows. I mean, when we started this band, I could not sing and play the guitar at the same time. So I'm proud to say that I can now both sing and play the guitar at the same time.
Would you say an American audience latch onto a band and will continue to love them, whereas that's part of the problem with the UK, that it's all about build them up, knock them down?
I mean, I don't think it's a reasonable thing to think that you can have a career in music. I mean, we occupy a place in the middle that is very fragile. Even just the size venues that we play almost by definition is like a place that no one resides. We play between like 1,000 and 2,000 people in most cities. It's very easy to be a band that plays for 200 people, and it's very easy to be a band that plays for 20,000 people. There's not that many venues that cater to the middle size act. There's just not that many middle size acts. Part of it is that the struggle continues as a working professional if you're a middle size act. Like, it doesn't physically easier. And I think a lot of people find that unsatisfying. I think a lot of musicians, they have lofty dreams, and if those dreams aren't fulfilled, it gets boring for them too. It just doesn't seem like fun. The things that are fun that you do when you're 22 can seem very unfun when you're 32. And so I think the fact that we kind of entered this as adults, we entered it with very practical ideas about what we wanted to get out of it. We've invested a lot of ourselves personally in we are sort of spiritually ambitious about the band. I mean, we feel like what we're doing is original, and that makes it actually very easy to go on, because it's like we're kind of fighting the good fight in our minds. Like, we're doing this thing that we think is really different and cool, and that just makes it much easier to put up with whatever banal travel there is in front of us. Sometimes I feel like we've just been lucky, and sometimes I feel like we've worked very hard to make our own luck. It's hard to say what endures. We're grateful that we have an audience that appreciates us. A lot of times audiences kind of freeze bands in a place, speaking of success, if you have a big hit and that's like all the people are oriented towards, that can be a very soul-crushing thing. Mm. I mean, we've done plenty of festivals where we've seen bands who have this really kind of sad relationship to their own hit song or their own success. They start to resent it in the most neurotic kind of way.
You covered Chumbawamba, Tub Thumping.
Oh, yeah.
And they had several albums as a fairly, cult band on indie labels. Then signed to EMI, that exploded. And I think a lot of their original fan base then resented them.
Well,
had a short-term new fan base,
Well, they seem like a complete enigma for a band in many ways, right? I mean, they were a collective. They were sort of born out of this highly idealistic. They're kind of a category of one in a way, but they did sort of fall to the all the problems of a one-hit wonder. And it's obviously a very glorious song. I mean, it combines, like, it's a drinking song. I feel like it's tapping into something that culturally is quite powerful here. You know, just a good drinking song has got to be, that would be a life changer for any band over here,
I would imagine. Was it a hit in the States?
Oh, it was huge in the States. Yeah, it was absolutely, and nobody even knew what they were talking about. I mean, it was just the pure joy of the track made it a hit in the United States. But, you know,
Pissing for us, pissing in the street. Pissing.
Yeah.
Whereas pissing to you is like pissed off, annoyed, isn't it?
There was no question about the lyrics. I think it really was just a bit of a UFO over in the United States. It really was just like the, you know, the sort of singing, chanting part of the song. We were here when it was happening here, and it was quite striking. But it was kind of a guilty pleasure when we did the cover of it. It was part of this. Strange thing that the Onion in the United States does, which is that they have this cover project every year. They have a whole set of songs, and there are very few songs left to pick from. And one of them was a Clash song. It's actually a pretty good song, and it was just like, there's no way to approach this and make it any good at all for us. You know, nobody wants to hear us ruin a Clash song. So the Chumbawamba song was kind of a happy accident. And the best thing about it was we actually asked the staff of the Onion if they would come in and sing the chorus with us. And it's all recorded in this tiny, intimate acoustic recording studio that they have set up. This is little tiny circular room. And we just piled in, 50 people. So it was automatically this incredibly physically uncomfortable thing. And then they're all just screaming along the chorus. And it kind of flipped that, you know, that ironic cover idea that people have, you know, like this song that's like, oh, you know, I mean, if you were going to cover Poison by Belle Biv DeVoe, people would be like, what? You know, like any song that's that of a time and of a place, when you cover it, it's kind of a loaded thing. But to actually do a version of it with all these people singing along, it's hard not to just kind of fall into the joy of it.
We'll be singing when we're winning. We'll be singing. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down.
He takes a cider drink, cider
drink, soda drink.
He sings a song that reminds him of a good time. He sings a song that reminds him of a good time.
Yeah.
So tell me about your podcast. So what's the name of the show?
It's after we have the Scarcello song.
It's after an Elvis Costello song.
Radio Radio. I couldn't think of a name, so I called it Radio Radio.
Fantastic. You know, I have a very personal, I wouldn't say a relationship with Elvis Costello, but my whole world revolves around Elvis Costello quite directly. When I was 17, I came to the UK and saw Elvis Costello perform I think it was billed as his first public performance, but it was actually the second night he had ever performed in public. And it really changed my life. I don't think I would have ever, I'm pretty positive I would never have been in a band if it wasn't for Elvis Costello. I mean, I didn't play any musical instrument at that time. I didn't, you know, I mean, I loved music. I loved a lot of things. And there was something about his performance that was extremely powerful and interesting to me. And it kind of was the beginning of everything for me.
Am I right in saying you came to the UK to see him? I read that somewhere, I think.
I didn't come to the UK to see him. I actually, I wrote one piece for a newspaper here years ago about seeing him. I came to the UK to check out punk rock music. You know, there was a piece on 60 Minutes in the United States, which is like a very sort of stodgy but often powerful news program that did exposés. It was Mike Wallace was the moderator of it. And they would do like all sorts of political things as well as sort of cultural things about trends. And they had this trend piece about punk rock, and the Sex Pistols were on it. And up until then, the only punk rock that I really knew about was like Patti Smith had a single out on Ork Records. Television had Little Johnny Jewel on it as a single. It was just a very small smattering of these bands from New York doing things that were kind of becoming infamous. And I'd heard the Ramones, and the Talking Heads had Love Goes to Building on Fire came out as a single. And all those things were kind of percolating. And there was word that there was like a London punk rock scene. But when I saw the Sex Pistols, I don't think I'm alone in this. The first thing I thought was, it seemed like the London extension of the Split Enz fan club. Like the actual fashion of it was very out of step with what I was 17 at the time, so my sense of fashion was pretty finite. But, you know, like there was this kind of, what you would think of now is like the new wave, like, you know, Batgirl kind of makeup and that sort of, that look. The only predecessor to it was this band Split Enz, which is the predecessor of Crowded House in Australia, who had a very, very strong kind of theatrical makeup look and costume. I don't even know if they wore like sort of torn up clothes. In some ways, they were very much, it was just very extremely new wave.
That's really interesting because the history books have never put Split Enz and punk together, and you have now.
So. Well, I mean, it's just, I mean, obviously the history of like makeup and hair and hair gel is something that, you know, it's, people are not going to talk about it seriously, but like, you know, the New York new wave punk rock scene and the Boston New York punk rock scene were very street level. They were very kind of come as you are. There was kind of if you had any kind of like larger affect, it was kind of seen as like a little bit suspect or theatrical. I mean, you get bands like, you know, Pere Ubu sometimes, you know, people kind of harken back to old like rock and roll kind of looks, but you know, by and large, it was kind of a just like street clothes kind of thing. Even the Ramones, as much as like people go, oh yeah, they were like in their leather jackets and everything like that. I mean, it was not a particularly, you know, I mean, anybody could do that. You know, what the Sex Pistols were doing was, you know, kind of well beyond that. And even the Clash, they looked kind of art directed in a way that no bands in New York really looked like. But I fell hook, line, and sinker for that stuff, and it really. It was really exciting. I was very grateful that it happened because my life could have been very, very boring.
You could have stayed in the office.
Not that it isn't plenty boring now, much of the time. Who knows? I'd probably be a graphic designer. I want to meet Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. I want to meet Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. I want to see Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. He wants to meet old Santa Claus. Brother to the department store, he wanted to show Santa his Christmas list. He stood in line and he shook like a leaf. He's only 5 1/2 going on 6. He said, is there really Santa Claus? Really, really Santa? Is that really Santa? Really, really Santa? Is that really Santa Claus? Really, really Santa? Hope he thinks that Santa Claus
said, you're not naughty Santa Claus, you're really not Santa Claus. You're not naughty Santa Claus, you're really not Santa. Being naughty Santa Claus, you're really not Santa. He's just helping Santa Claus. Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. He's helping Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. He's just helping Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. He's just helping Santa Claus. He's just helping Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. He's just helping Santa Claus, a real, real Santa. He's just helping Santa Claus.
You're tuned to Rodeo Radio with Gareth Jones.
Once a year, my friend puts on a red suit and hangs around with me and my pie. Now I can't help but feeling jealous each time she climbs on his knee. And she stands beneath the mistletoe screaming for him to stand beneath the mistletoe screaming.
Let's talk about Christmas for a moment, John.
Yes.
Well, first of all, Santa's beard.
Now, uh-huh.
I make indie alternative sort of mix, well, not mix tapes anymore, mix CDs and stuff mm-hmm. for friends. And I've always put that back to back with the Beach Boys' Santa's Beard. And I've always wondered, was that a coincidence or?
We worked with a performance art group called Watchface that did this kind of chant. It's hard to even describe their act. But in the East Village when we started, they had a duo act called Stereotype, where they would just be sort of chanting different kind of stereotype phrases that you would hear in the world. And then they did a show called Stereotype and Quad, where there would be four people all chanting, and it would be like, it was kind of like sketch comedy in a way, but it was a little bit more abstracted than that. Like one person would be chanting, and if they were doing a thing about like theater, one person would be going like, I cannot sing in green, I cannot sing in green. So they had all these different chants in their show, and one of them was Santa Beards. They had a holiday theme thing. And so I just, that was just kind of stuck in my head. But we've become aware of the fact that there's a Beach Boys song called Santa's Beard. Although I don't even really know the song, Beard.
You didn't know it then?
No. I mean, I know a lot of Beach Boys songs, but I don't know that one. It seems kind of obscure. But we have about a billion songs that share titles with other songs. And, you know, a lot of times it's a little confounding because I wrote a song called Your Racist Friend that I realize was based on the spark of it, of the title. Not the spark of the idea for the song, but the spark of the title was based on like hearing a bunch of college students kind of laughing and joking, poking at each other, sort of echoing this thing that I didn't realize that they were referencing a song by the Specials that's called Racist Friend. And, you know, I just thought they were like some politically correct kids they were like college radio kids on a college campus. I went to Antioch College where things were highly politicized and people actually used the term politically correct unironically. You know, so I was used to a certain kind of banter that was wouldn't be completely out of place to hear something like that. And I didn't, you know, this is in a pre-Google era where things like that could happen quite freely and you wouldn't know. I mean, I'll tell you, like, if I knew there was a song called Racist Friend, the first thing I would do is not write a song called Racist Friend, because, you know, you just, what is that? You know, like, what, you know, it's the people who know the other song are going to be like, that seems like a very strange move.
This is where the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend. If you have a racist friend, now is the time, now is the time.
And you know, we put the track together with Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley, who, like, I think even might have worked with the Specials. And I'm surprised that they didn't, like, pull us aside and sort of go, like, you know, there's this other track that's the thing. You know, the original song, Racist Friend, is a tremendous track, and I've become aware of it since then. But I feel like I could never explain to the, you know, thank God for podcasts, because now you can explain to the world how the haphazard method by which a song title can come into the world.
I'm glad I asked about Sanders.
Yes, again. Yeah. Well, there's more. I mean, there's tons more. There's a very popular DJ in MC guy named MC Frontalot who does, like, nerdcore songs in the United States, and he's got a song called Spoiler Alert that evidently is quite famous in that world. And we, They Might Be Giants, actually, sort of unbeknownst to ourselves, loom quite large in that world because we're sort of the predecessors of this whole kind of thing that's happening with this nerdcore thing in the United States. And we put out a song called Spoiler Alert. And it was actually we actually changed the title from, like, the song was originally called Party in the USA, which was John Linnell basically was trying to think of, like, this sort of, like, the most stupid generic name that you might see on a set list in a rehearsal hall. Like, if you go into a rehearsal hall, you'll always see, like, you know, Rock and Roll Girl, or, like, you know, Danger Zone. Like, these kind of, they're sort of typical song titles in a rehearsal hall. They're just, like, the most mediocre song titles of all time. And Party in the USA is, like, kind of, like, along with Danger Zone and Rock and Roll Girl, is probably, like, those are the big three, like, worst titles of all time. And so we just titled that song. And then as we were putting out the record, I guess it was Miley Cyrus had a song called Party in the USA. And I was like, if we put out a song with the title Party in the USA, everybody's going to think that we're riffing on her. This is somehow a reflection on her, which was certainly not our intent. So we switched it to Spoiler Alert, which fits the song because the song has got kind of like a surprise ending, or it's all leading to this one inevitable ending. And then it turns out that there's this very popular song by a contemporary of ours, you know, sort of in our same musical genre called Spoiler Alert. And I'm sure there are people who are just like, those They Might Be Giants fuckers. They just keep on stealing ideas.
Here comes this truck. This truck has a mind of its own. Hearing which is the last key thing, and the cause end of my the leg book is so short that I can't reach the brake.
Yeah,
what this truck is driving out of my mind. But this truck has a mind of its own.
Driving
while I'm making a phone call, while I'm searching for my love box, while I'm writing so short that I can't reach the brake.
They're gonna be so fast.
Something is nagging at me
when they get a load of me,
but never mind.
to steer. One scratch,
maybe
my head
I should lie back
to cover my eyes,
which would help.
I think I'll do that.
Let's talk merch quickly, John.
Sure.
I mean, many people have asked you, where do you get the ideas for your songs? I'm asking where you get the ideas for your merch. Do you sit around with a big mug of tea and say, yeah, flask, playing cards, skateboards?
Well, you know, these are desperate times for rock bands. So creative thinking in the world of merchandising is often job one.
Tell us what we've got for the holidays this year.
We are coming out with a skateboard that looks quite beautiful, actually. And we just recently had an idea that was put forward by our merchandising company that I had never even heard of. It's like a faux Christmas sweater, and it relates to this television program called A Christmas Story. Have you ever seen this?
I posted the picture on my Facebook saying, look at this awful jumper.
See, people know.
And a friend said, oh, it's from a film or a TV
It's
special.
Evidently extremely famous. A lot of cultural references from 1980 are completely lost on me because I was just like sitting like reading Gang of Four liner notes while everybody else was watching like Star Wars sequels and evidently seeing this film, A Christmas Story, which is evidently very campy and kind of appalling. But so it doesn't do anything. I've actually had no cultural reference. Like, I was on a conference call and people are looking at this design. I'm like, I don't know, this looks kind of awkward and a little bit ugly. I don't quite understand it. And they're like, that's the whole point. It's supposed to be awkward and ugly. You know, it's like...
It's a picture of a stockinged leg in a lampshade.
It's right? I guess it's about the worst Christmas ever. It's like the theory of is the sort of the gist of this thing. But getting back to the merchandise, what generates the ideas for the merchandise, I collaborate with a graphic designer named Paul Serre on a lot of things. We did a deck of cards last year that was all about, it was like a complete alternate deck of cards. Like it wasn't just diamonds, jacks, clubs, hearts. It was all new faces, and it was based on cryptids and all these other mythic, some science fiction, some mythical, some supernatural, basically all kind of ghostly faces for cards. And that was a really elaborate project, and like it actually involved research and a lot of design, and I'm not sure why we did it, but it just seemed like a really interesting project. I started in graphic design, and that was kind of my background, so I've always enjoyed like the challenge of putting together album artwork and kind of keeping the visual side of things alive for They Might Be Giants, and doing interesting merch is kind of just, you know, another part of that.
Expect to find a salesman drinking coffee this late in the morning. How long you been here, Joe?
Oh, I don't know. I guess 45 minutes, maybe. Why do you ask?
You must be making a lot of sales, piling up good income.
Oh, Johnny Cake, right?
I'm not back on the show. Still on it.
Avalanche rolled by. I was a snowball in hell. Avalanche rolled by. A jailer trapped in his cell. Money I owe. Money I owe. Money I owe. Money I owe. Avalanche rolled by. I was a snowball in hell. Yes, I was a snowball in hell. Yes, I was a snowball in hell.
Well, we're looking forward to the show tonight, John, and quite often some British celebrities turn up to your shows. We've had Tim Minchin, well, he's not British, but Tim Minchin, Phil Jupitus, Jonathan Ross.
Yep.
Do you know Adam Buxton?
I don't know Adam Buxton personally.
He knows you.
Oh, absolutely.
is it the same case in the States? Do you have, you know, does Steve Martin turn up or, you know?
You know, we've had famous people come to our shows, and they're people that we've met on our way through our career that, like, we became friends with before they were famous. I mean, that actually feels like the most natural thing. But I'll tell you, like the Jonathan Ross connection is interesting to me because we were on the Jonathan Ross show when he was already notorious here. I mean, I think he was actually very, very kind of white hot at the moment that we were on his show. We simply had no idea who he was. And no one had told us anything about his show or that we should be, you know, a lot of times when you go on a show like that, people will say like, oh, you should be careful because he's going to be, you know, he'll put you on the spot and all this stuff. And we were not only unafraid of Jonathan Ross, I think we were like vaguely like, we weren't particularly impressed with the show. And, you know, we were polite, we were conversational, we were present, but we were also, like, very frank. And I think it was already at a time that, like, there were so many people just kind of blowing smoke and towards, you know, to him and just kind of feeding into whatever the mythocracy of, like, celebrity is in this country, which is show business looms large in a lot of people's minds. And I think in a strange way, he was greatly relieved that we were not cowed by him. I don't think he had encountered many people that who are not kind of in some way trying to suck up to him. I mean, we weren't rude. I mean, but we just were...
We're
just being nice and, like, you know, just being regular people. And I think at that point I think he'd realize, like, you know, when people get famous, there can be like a deficit of normal people in your life. You know, people start acting weird. So it's kind of nice when you know, somebody doesn't get all freaky.
And you became friends through that, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was like, it was a very easy acquaintance. And you know, I mean, he's got a lot of other interests, you know. He's like a really interesting guy. And, you know, obviously he's got a very, you know, strong radio and TV personality. But it's like, you know, he's also, you know, he's like, he's a really smart guy.
Well, John, I won't keep you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. O Tannenbaum, o Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter.
Musik.
They Might Be Giants with their version of the Christmas classic O Tannenbaum from originally on a 7-inch, green 7-inch vinyl, which I have a copy of, actually. It looks very nice, but I got it off eBay. I didn't buy it when it originally came out. And it was not as described. It was described as new, you know, very good condition. When it arrived, a little bit scuffed around the edges, the sleeves a little bit torn, a little bit bent. So I did leave some nasty eBay feedback. So if you sold that record to me, then... anyway, originally on a 7-inch vinyl, later available on the Holidayland EP, They Might Be Giants with their version of O Tannenbaum. I've been playing, obviously, some Christmas songs scattered around the interview because it is Christmas time. So, sorry, if you're not into Christmas songs, I do apologise. But for me, you know, it's a big deal. So if you were expected to just hear lots of normal They Might Be Giants songs, well, you know, you can go and listen to them anytime. Christmas songs are just for Christmas, aren't they? So thanks very much to John. It was really nice to meet him. We had a good chat and I learned some interesting things there, particularly the bit about, you know, sharing song titles. You know, I mean, they're quite an unusual band and quite quirky lyrics and quirky song titles. So the very fact that they have a song called Santa's Beard, I mean, you would think they would probably be the only band in the world that would have a song called Santa's Beard. And yet it shares a title with the Beach Boys. And I thought of another one, Mink Car. Mink Car, again, a fairly unique title for a song. But The Cure also have a song called Mink Car. So there we go. And apparently there are plenty more. So if you go through the They Might Be Giants back catalogue, I'm sure you'll find other song titles by them, by other artists. So keep looking. Maybe we can do a follow-up on another edition next time they come to the UK in like 4 or 5 years or whatever. Anyway, thanks very much to John. Thank you for listening, especially if you're in the USA. And, well, that's it for this edition of Radio Radio. But in a few days' time, depending when you're listening to this and downloading it and streaming it or whatever, my Christmas special will be coming out. So I'm very excited about that. And I'll be joined by Rebecca and Charles from the UK band Slow Club, because they released a Christmas EP back in 2009. So Rebecca and Charles from Slow Club will be chatting to me about their Christmas EP. And then small indie label Cherryade Records put out a Christmas compilation album every year. And I'll be speaking to the head of the label, Rachel Nyman, talking all about Christmas records and releasing Christmas compilation albums. So that's all coming up in the next edition of Radio Radio in a few days' time. If you visit the website at radioradiopodcast.podomatic.com, that's a Radio Radio Podcast, that's all one word, no gaps, radioradiopodcast.podomatic.com, and then the next edition, the Christmas edition, will magically appear in a few days' time, so you can stream and download to your Christmas delight. That's my special gift to you. So that's coming up very soon. But that's the end of this one. I won't yab it anymore. So thank you very much for listening. See you on the Christmas special. Cheers.